Welcome to the Psychomedia Podcast. I'm Timothy Swan.
And I'm Ben Fell, and together we're going to be discussing the funny side of psychology.
That's right, we go together like cheddar cheese and peanut butter, by which I mean better than you'd think.
Now, in the interest of full disclosure, we were off last week. It was tragic. It was my fault, my stupid internet.
I wouldn't blame you.
Well.
I blame Ian Virgin.
Damn you, Ian Virgin. Anyway, so hopefully the internet will hold out this time. There may be some like weird crackly things if it doesn't. But yeah, we'll do our best. And apologies for last week. I hope you enjoyed the Franken podcast.
I've listened to it. I think it worked quite well, really,
okay,
considering. But we can't do another one because I'm out of body parts.
Okay.
So unless I go Burke and Hare on some kind of other podcasts.
Well, I could record some lectures.
I was tempted to go back to do our like pre-show discussions, but I don't think there's anything that good in there.
Okay, fair enough.
Also, we'd lose our clean tag. There's one where there's a great joke, but it is just, you know.
Oh, well. We could do like an X-rated Psychomedia Uncut.
Too hot for the internet, which, if you think about it...
That's pretty bad.
Pretty hot. Yes, we probably ought to go straight to the feedback.
Well, because, just before
Ben thinks it's going to be a short episode. I think it's going to be a long episode. So in order to help win that bet...
Just before we do that, and in order to help lose my bet, I would also like to say apologies. I am ill. I have a horrible cold. And so you are getting the husky late night radio DJ voice from me this week. I may also not seem to be laughing quite as much as I should, because every time I laugh, I get a hacking coughing fit that sounds like a dying bear. So I may have to mute my microphone a little bit more than usual.
Basically, the bit where I attempt to be purely funny later on
is going to fall flat on its ass.
I was going to say, if I kill you, then I win.
This is always true. Anyway.
We love each other, really. So, yes, Jessica James commented on episode four.
Is that the Jesse J? No, Jesse J? Is that Jesse J? Jesse J.
I was thinking you were thinking of Jesse James, as in the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. Soundtrack is amazing.
Mm. No, I was thinking of the popular recording artist.
No, well, let me read out her comment and then I'll tell you all that I know about her.
Okay, you do that.
I just listened to this episode while out for a walk alone. When Ben boomed the word choose, can you do it again?
Choose.
Into my headphones, I nearly fell over. I'm surprised no one on the street attempted to assist me as I laughed spasmodically. Maybe a podcast on the diffusion of responsibility and the bystander effect are in order. I'm really enjoying the podcast. Thank you, Tim and Ben. So,
you said her name was Jessie, not Kitty.
Yeah, Jessica. Okay. And she works for a mysterious organization called Section 31, which is named after the covert division of Starfleet in Star Trek. And she subscribed via email, so that's how I know these things. John D. commented on episode 5. He said maybe the DuckDuckGo secret search engine hit was me, and he thought it was maybe the RSS guy, but then he realized that he doesn't have any idea what RSS mix is. But he does listen to Hot Dog Network, Overthinking It, and Us. As for your podcast, good job so far and getting better every week. It was cool to hear about Larry Squire, whom I've run into on campus.
Oh my God.
Also, I spent the last week telling everybody about the fMRI and snake study, and I told my students they had to be careful about defining personhood, since the scrub jay is always waiting in the wings to be a counterexample at a moment's notice.
That's amazing. So we're actually podcasting to people in positions of, you know, academic authority.
The University of California at San Diego, which we'll be talking about a fair bit more later.
We shall indeed. That's amazing.
We've got something to look forward to, John D, and we have something to look forward to. Please feedback.
Yes, more feedback, please, John D, since hopefully we're going to be talking about another
Jessica
one of your colleagues.
James, but the fact that John D is on the campus with Professor Squire, I mean, that's just... The chances are that both Dr. Buckley and Dr. Squire might actually hear about what we've done. Bet you never thought that was going to happen. Apart from
one of those outcomes is definitely better than the other for us.
Yeah, we're going to get killed with foils. Alex B. from Overthinking It has discovered the Psychomedia podcast because I told him about it.
This is quite a direct way of marketing it, isn't it? Tim just goes around the internet telling people.
I think we were having a discussion because it had come up on Overthinking It about what mediates low-level visual processing, because the host of the Overthinking It podcast, Matthew Rather, whose grandmother was the producer of the original Lassie TV series. Amazing, okay, amazing family. But he once dressed as a woman to go to school. And it was only noticed when he started to speak, which is a darn sight better than my cross-dressing efforts, I might add. he was saying, oh, maybe it's because people aren't very good at recognizing the difference between men and women. And the trouble is they are at a really low level. We've talked about that in the Franken podcast. So I think we were talking about psychology, and Alex B was like, oh, you know, that's interesting. I'm like, oh, if you're interested in that, I have a thing you might be interested in. It wasn't just like completely unsettled. My dad listened on the way back from Bristol the other day, and we have an iPod plug into our car, and he completely missed the junction he was supposed to get off at. Too busy listening to episode 2. He was completely distracted. That's
brilliant. I should say, like, I think it's really sweet the way you and your family listen to this podcast. I also think it's really weird. I could not imagine listening to this with my parents, mainly because my mum did apparently listen to a little bit of the first episode and was deeply concerned that we were going to get like sued and taken to court and put in prison. And to be honest, I'm not entirely sure it's quite their cup of tea. But
Kiha, who has got a real name, but because Watership Down is so amazing, I'm going to continue to call him Kiha, says, hey Tim, enjoying Psychomedia. I find running in the wind, brackets cooling my face, makes me happy. But that could also be endorphins.
A program. Dogs in cars.
Oh.
Dogs stick their heads out of windows of cars and
Science
it makes them
never
happy.
Mentioned that.
Proof.
He says that a program on exercise / sports psychology would be good, and also war, because he is like a runner and also a historian who knows a lot about military history. Matt.
Exercise / sport.
I think war. There's I can think of one war study we did in together with your supervisor.
What is it good for? absolutely nothing. ? Okay. P < 0.05.
Matt, who is also known as the Grampus, which is an old name for a killer whale, also subscribes and says, been catching up with the Psychomedia podcast. Tim has now convinced me that all love is a mental illness. Now to tell the wife. I said that was your and he said, well, don't tell him that I love the cake thing, because that will only encourage him.
You had any good cake this week, Tim?
I don't think I have had any cake. I had some cheesecake, but it was vanilla cheesecake, which is fine, but it's not as good as, you know, fruity cheesecake. So Kiha and Grampus do a podcast called Dissecting Worlds. I'm on the next episode, so look out for that. Anyway, so on this most recent episode on Captain America, which of course has so much to do with psychology, I'm going to refer to another excellent podcast. I listen to Psychomedia, which is a comic, as in comedic, podcast on psychoanalysis. No, it's not about psychoanalysis. They'll hate me for that. It's about psychology. And they were talking about attractiveness and sense of humor and attractiveness. The studies that have been done are basically that, yeah, sense of humor is great if you're attractive. Right. Oh, it's a reinforcing agent, not a factor itself. Yeah. So from the point of view of leadership, maybe Steve Rogers would have been a brilliant leader in anything. He would have been the best copy room sub-editor in a comic book company on the Lower East Side, but no one listens to him because he's a weedy little guy. No, in that context, he wouldn't be a great leader, but the fact that you're 280 pounds of pure muscle, 6'4", and cut like a frickin' steak accentuates any inherent leadership ability that you might have. And they then talk about Nixon versus Kennedy.
Ah.
And later they say, the Psychomedia podcast, we're having Tim on in the next month when we discuss Aslan and gods and leadership. It is an excellent listen, and I strongly recommend it. Two guys who studied psychology talking about it with a wry sense of humour. So that's very nice of them, and I will obviously be promoting us on their show because it's a great show, and everyone should look it up on the Geek Syndicate Network, which is also a very good network, but Dissecting Worlds is a very good podcast on the social sciences in geek culture. So I think if you like this, you'll probably find some common ground with them. Can you believe it? There's still more stuff. Alex Colgan said, I think Psychomedia is awesome. I've only studied a little psychology, but I still really enjoy it. The use of Freud as a swear word is simply classic. So pardon my French there. Well, my Austro-Hungarian, Jewish, Czech, I don't know. German, I suppose. And
probably.
Finally, we're going to do a dramatized reenactment of what was probably my favorite feedback of the week, and all of it was amazing. Thank you, everyone. There's a reason we've just spent about 15 minutes doing it, because it's all so wonderful, and we want to, like, recognize all of you. But I wrote into Advice Hot Dog asking for some hot dog advice, and they talked about my hair, but they also talked about the podcast. So we're going to reenact that for you now.
Hang on, let me get the script.
You're so unprofessional.
I'm sorry. Okay. Right. Where's the Tim Swan podcast, by the way? I want to listen to the Tim Swan podcast.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I listened to his podcast, the latest one, and then I decided I needed to go back and listen to the first one, you know, in order. I think their podcast is something that you have to listen to in order. Him and his partner, they're both psychology majors or professors or really into psychology.
I think you just think of them as professors because they have English accents.
Sure, I think of any...
I think it's possible that they are 9 years old.
No, I think they're of podcasting age and they answer psychology questions.
They're not what we often refer to as pod bait.
Yeah, it's true.
Underage podcasters that just seem more, you know, he was really mature.
Yeah, they seem like they could podcast, but they were faking it. And then they talk about some... Unsalubrious, I can't remember which one of those words is good, neither sounds good, things, but they, at the end, tell them, their listeners, their many, many listeners, the name of the podcast, and I believe we do have an email subscriber on that account, a Mr. Pitre, I don't know, from New Brunswick, which is in Canada, and he also listens to the other shows in the Hot Dog Network, so that's great. I know I said that was the last feedback. I kind of lied. friend of the show / guy who listens to the show
slash just the same
man,
thing,
Kieran, rated us 5 stars on iTunes, reviewing us as the best psychology-based comedy podcast on the web. An awesome show.
Wow, that's great, because we can now... We, according to the rule of newspaper reviews on the back of film and DVD boxes, we can now refer to ourselves as the best psychology podcast on the web.
To be honest, you know, slim
brackets
competition.
Kieran, 5 stars.
Yeah, we need to come up with like some valuable sourcing in a way. I mean, the trouble is with podcasts is you don't tend to do posters for them. Well,
that's
I mean,
true.
Unless you've been doing anything while we've been away. But yeah. At some point in the future, we'll explain to you psychologically why you should rate us 5 stars. And I desperately hope that the evidence does support that you'll enjoy it more if you do. But if you do want to rate us on iTunes, it is literally clicking a number of stars. If you want to write something, feel free. But otherwise, click a number of stars, because then you can say to all the new fans, I'm a hipster and I was into them before they were popular.
Oh, just allow us to sink into insignificance and... obscurity.
Hey, we have a great number of listeners. I'm
we
stunned
do.
It's and wonderful.
It is, and thank you to you all. Anyway, after our longest feedback session yet, which really doesn't bode well for the podcast, that maybe
we had
first...
2 weeks, that's why.
Actually, you mentioned there that if I had been doing anything this week, I would have made posters. That is not true. I have been doing stuff this week, but I did not make posters. Would you like to kick off the stuff, what we have done this week, or shall I?
I'll kick it off. Actually, well, I've been talking for a long time, but I'll kick it off, because then you
go
can
on
talk
then
about some stuff.
People seem to like it when you talk.
they like it when you talk too. It's just that most of the feedback methods seem to go to me rather than to you.
Which, not enough to remember my name, though.
I think it's deliberate now. but you should get a Twitter, and maybe a Twitter that is like at the Ben Fell or something, because maybe then, you know, people would be able to tell you directly how much they love you. Anyway,
well, we'll
this week or last week, but it's happening this week, I entered a stand-up competition, because why not? It's not like I've never done it before or anything. And I finally got the details for it, and it requires 2 to 3 minutes of material, and I've written a lot more than that. But if you don't mind, Ben, I'd quite like to see if I can destroy you with humour and practice my routine.
Okay, so what the way this is going to work is it's going to be kind of like one of those clapometers that they have on shows like The X Factor or whatever, if they do. I've never watched.
Exactly. We're so alienated from the popular culture.
It's so yeah, we're going to do that, except that because I seem to be coughing when I laugh, what I'm going to do is I'm going to move the mic slightly further away from my mouth, and then the amount of coughs that you receive will be an indication of how good your stand-up is.
Okay. Here we go. Is this thing on? Yeah, that's right. My first joke was both supersonic and also not very funny. There's a dog groaning in the next street. I love countries that don't exist anymore. I love reading about Bohemia and Livonia, and all of the breakaway republics too. You know, there used to be a place called Transjordan? It's called Katie Price these days. Along with being a comedian, or the nearest available sewer alternative, I'm also a novelist, and this has given a certain personal enmity for Miss Price. I suppose, as they say, everyone has their price. Well, mine is Katie Price. Now, my enmity for her is not merely because she sells hundreds of thousands of books, whereas I have yet to have one published, but because she has a ghostwriter. Well, that's not unusual. Not unusual, that is, amongst the illiterate celebrities when they're doing their autobiographies. But what really gets my goat, as thoroughly as if it had been taken by Somalian pirates, is that she didn't even hire a writer. She hired a radio producer. A radio producer to ghost a book by someone who is, for whatever reason, called a glamour model. And that much, I suppose, is acceptable. But then it's not enough for her to have two autobiographies. She, for no adequately explored reason, needs a novel. You know, I'd quite like to be able to do that. Oh, excuse me, Miss Farnsworth, could you be a dear and run off me off a slightly fictionalised version of my life which suggests nudity is in itself a positive career aspiration for women? I'd do it myself, but, you know, we're out of milk. The heart-rending part of it is that Miss Farnsworth did want to be a writer and never got the break for herself until she'd written 7 books as Miss Price. That level of sacrifice, I mean, it's unheard of. Although I think it could lead to some great literature. After all, we all know that Shakespeare didn't get to put on the Two Gentlemen of Verona until he'd done a number of autobiographies for renowned Tudor glamour model Elizabeth I. Now, statistically, I reckon that a lot of people have posted about the film The Social Network on Facebook. A good few people have dreamt about Inception. Ladies and gentlemen, let me be the first person on Earth to dance about Black Swan. Thank you very much. What do you think? Good. A single clap.
Well, I mean, there were more, but my internet cut out. Yeah, that was good. That was good. I would laugh at that.
Yeah,
I mean,
I did, and coughed,
and I hope the coughing
judges.
Didn't... Yeah, I hope the coughing didn't get in the way of any of the punchlines.
No, it didn't in my ears.
Okay. You can always fade me down in the mix.
Yes, because we do this in a really professional studio. Which I do not mean a bedroom where there is a desk at one end and it's covered in CDs because I don't need them anymore. Yeah.
In my case, it's a bedroom where there is a book on the table, a bed behind me, and a large bottle of port staring me straight in the face.
You've got to fight it, Ben. Fight
Why?
Port. You probably
I'm
will.
Ill.
Port is good for you when you're ill, right?
It's a port SIBO.
So apart from being ill, what have you been doing this week? Did you watch a movie?
I did watch a movie, as is definitely a thing now. This week, I watched Tucker and Dale versus Evil.
Which
is... I saw the trailers for and was like, I have to watch that film because it's got Alan Tudyk in it. Alan Tudyk of Firefly, Serenity, A Knight's Tale... Death at a Funeral, Fame. He is awesome. He has a cuddly face, and he's fantastic. He was also, Dollhouse as well. He's amazing in Dollhouse. So it was him and a guy called Tyler Labine. Alas, not L-E space B-E-A-N, which would have been a much better surname, in my opinion. But yes, Tyler Labine. He was also, weirdly, in Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which is good, and a bunch of other things. So the film was really good. I really enjoyed it. It's kind of like comedy, horror, business. The significant things for the purposes of this podcast about it were the heroine is a psychologist studying her bachelor's in science,
Hooray!
Psychologist in America, so go her, she's awesome. She even at one point uses psychology to fight evil. When she, the whole film is based on the idea of miscommunication. I won't spoil much of it for you, but basically, yeah, there is a terrible miscommunication which leads to lots of people being grisly murdered / accidentally killed. It's kind of like a cross between
Flash.
Final Destination and I really should have thought that simile through, because there are definitely films about like mistaken identity. But I can't think of any right now. So it's one of those.
The importance of being earnest?
Yeah, actually.
That's the only one I can think of.
What, like a Shakespeare play? Where
a chainsaw?
It is exactly that.
Is it Maggie Smith or is it the other one? Is it Dame Judi Dench, I think it is?
One of those. One of those.
Imagine Dame Judi Dench with a chainsaw. You've basically got Red, I guess.
Exactly. Or was
that Helen Mirren? I get all of the Dames confused.
That would be an amazing horror film. Helen Mirren, Dame Judi Dench, and Maggie Smith as three psychotic chainsaw-wielding murderers. Okay. Hollywood, if you're listening, make that film. Anyway, heroine psychologist uses therapy to try
Maggie
and defuse
Smith
the situation.
Serial killer in...
Oh, right. You're done.
Plays a serial killer in Keeping Mum, isn't it? Maggie Smith, who plays a serial killer in that?
I do not know. But I bet she doesn't wield the chainsword. Chainsaw. Wow. Whoops. Anyway.
Okay. It's a good film. You should watch
it. The final point is that...
Chainsaw.
Oh, man. For those of you in the audience who recognize that particular little Freudian slip there. Sorry, F-wordian slip. Shame on you. And we were all 15 and male at one point. Anyway, the final point about Tucker and Dale versus Evil is that at one point in it, one of the it's got like the standard set of American college student victims. One of them identifies herself as a sociologist, which bodes very ill. And she then goes on to misdiagnose someone with Stockholm syndrome, which is clearly like outside of her academic purview, so she shouldn't be even talking about it, which causes the breakdown of communications, indirectly sets fire to Alan Tudyk's vacation home, and then she gets hit in the face with a strimmer. So justice is served, and any sociologist listening, watch out. Stay off our turf.
Yeah. Hey, Ben, you know what I didn't do this week?
What didn't you do this week?
I didn't do anything that allows us to segue forcibly into what we're actually going to talk about.
Well, I did. So that's good.
Wait. Well, can I then talk about something that I did do?
Yeah.
I went to a concert in Bristol to see Amazing. This is my normal state. Look them up on Bandcamp or Last.fm or just Google. This is my normal state. They are one of my favorite post-rock bands. I'm wearing their t-shirt because they had t-shirts for the first time. And, they're very friendly to me whenever I go to their gigs. So shout out to them. Carry on.
Well, that is cool. I'm currently wearing a handmade t-shirt which says "No power in the verse can stop me." Something for your the other Alan Tudyk fans out there. So, in this week's belabored segue, I have been reading as well as watching this week. This week, I have been reading a book called Phantoms in the Brain, which is written by V.S. Ramachandran and apparently also someone called Sandra Blakesley. However, the person we're interested in is V.S. Ramachandran, for he is the subject of this week's podcast. What's his first name, Tim?
Oh, well... Technically, Ramachandran is his first name.
Okay.
He's from a part of India where the surname comes first. So he is Vilayanur Subramanian Ramachandran.
Okay.
But he now treats Ramachandran as his surname, and his first name is basically V.S.
Okay.
Because you hear about guys from India who are known as V.S. and V.J. and that sort of business.
Oh, very well. In that case...
Because his wife is now... Her double-barreled name is Rogers Ramachandran.
Oh, I see. I remember that name.
I believe she's his wife, Diane Rogers Ramachandran.
So, anyway, I have been reading his book. It is called Phantoms in the Brain, and we're going to be talking about a load of studies from that this week because the book is amazing. It's wonderfully good read. He is a fantastic kind of popular science author. He has a very, very good... sort of writing style for this kind of science, and is very funny as well, which is part of the reason why I've chosen him. He does very cool experiments. Yep. And writes about them in an extremely engaging and amusing way. However, that is not the only book that I've been reading this week. I'm also working my way diligently through the Song of Ice and Fire trilogy, series by George R. R. Martin. I mention this primarily because it is the most depressing and crushingly upsetting series of fantasy novels that I've ever read. Any attachments you form to any character in that series are immediately kind of dragged out from underneath you and battered into a bloody pulp. And the point about this is it comes to a pretty pass when I start reading Phantoms in the Brain, which is a series of case notes about people with debilitating brain damage, as light relief for my fantasy novel about dragons and swords and things. And to return to a topic that we've covered previously in the podcast, they should stop using sad music for mood induction, and they should just get people to read the entire of Song of Ice and Fire.
Oh yeah, because that's a quick procedure.
Exactly. So yeah, this week, as we mentioned sort of tentatively on the last real podcast, this is sort of a kind of shout out to our large number of Indian listeners. Props to you guys. Thanks for listening. And so we are going to discuss one of our favorite psychologists, and should be one of your favorite psychologists, Ramachandran.
Yes. So shall I tell the listeners what we know about Ramachandran, the man?
Yes.
The legend.
The man, the myth, the legend.
V.S. Ramachandran, who was also known as Rama, which I have found myself calling him. It's his nickname, but, I have had to write it so many times that I did start just writing Rama. He is a neuroscientist at the University of California, San Diego, which is the same as we've already said, Professor Larry Squire. Woo-hoo. He's known as the Marco Polo of neuroscience and the modern Paul Broca, who we may mention next week, but, who was a pioneering neuroscientist. So, yes, his father was a UN diplomat. Apparently that's not a word. A UN diplomat. His grandfather co-wrote the Indian Constitution.
Wow. Good pet.
Ramachandran started his research on conches and looked into that for a bit.
Wasn't he rescued from the island at that point?
Well, this is the thing, is he published a paper in Nature, probably the most prestigious scientific journal, in his second year of undergraduate.
Wow. That is crushing.
Puts us in perspective, really, doesn't it?
Actually, to return to the point about the conch, in the opening chapter to his book, he does give an example in which he talks about a talking pig. I'm starting to think there might be a trend in his work. But anyway, carry on.
According to Ramachandran in an interview for the university, he says, "Too much of the Victorian sense of adventure in science has been lost. Science has become too professionalized. It began as a grand romantic enterprise and is now too like an ordinary 9-to-5 job." Finally, before we actually talk about some of the research, an interest in paleontology led him to purchase a fossil dinosaur skull from the Gobi Desert, which was named after him as Minotaurosaurus Ramachandrani. A picture will be going in the show note.
God.
The Ramachandran Minotaur is a thing.
Is that... I am literally...
Have you seen the picture,
the most awesome thing I've ever heard in my life.
the picture makes it look pretty amazing as well.
Oh, man. Ramachandran, just like... If at any point you listen to this, when it's dug up as archaeological evidence, just... You're the man. You are so the man. Anyway.
Yes, that's what we do with our podcast. We burn them onto CD and then bury them in the Gobi Desert.
Are you not doing that?
Oh, was that my job? I thought that was your job. I have to edit it.
You're such a bad producer.
Do you want to tell us what made Ramachandran's name? Some of the stuff from the book, given you've been reading it.
Yeah, so, there's big things and there's little things. The book itself, I didn't say this before and I really should have done. Basically, you can consider this podcast as one massive advert for this book. If you're in any way interested in psychology, neurology, brain damage, or any of this cool stuff, then read it. I can heartily recommend it. But what it is essentially a collection of the most peculiar cases of people whose brains cause them to behave in weird and inexplicable ways. So, I mean, in that regard, it's a bit like the X Factor, except that that's kind of doing Ramachandran's patients a disservice because they actually have brain damage and they're also much more interesting. So, I mean, there are a few like little examples. I mentioned the talking pig. This is kind of his way of explaining things. Other people would use kind of in a dry example, and he involves a talking pig. At one point, he quotes Star Wars to explain how the dorsal visual stream works. He uses Baywatch to explain the dichotomy between modularity and globalism.
Does David Hasselhoff represent globalism?
I don't.
And Pamela Anderson represent modularity?
She is quite modular, but I think
you've just turned that into like a dirty misogynistic word now, haven't you?
Yes.
Look what you've done.
What? Like
you've ruined Fodor's day is what you've done. Fodor is the biggest promoter of modularity.
Anyway, and finally, this isn't really anything to do with Ramachandran, but he does at one point mention something which I found awesome on the subject of nominative determinism, which has cropped up previously, i.e. people whose names pigeonhole them into certain avenues of life. The two scientists responsible, quite importantly, for the term body image were Lord Russell Brain and Henry Head, which is
I love the fact that they teamed up.
Yeah.
Because one of the people who listens to the Monk in My Back podcast and now contributes thought that your name, before he heard it said by you, was your surname was Fowl. And so we were Swan and Fowl, the poultry duo.
Unfortunately not. We are Fell Swan. I figured like possibly the best way to introduce Ramachandran and his wonderful science to the world, our wonderful listeners.
Our global base.
Our global base. Yeah, exactly. Make it sound like the Thunderbirds. Is to describe like some of his really classic work. And a lot of the early parts of the book and a lot of the studies that he's published are on the subject of phantom limbs, which are fascinating and weird and very interesting. Very interesting from a psychological, neurological, and in kind of a philosophical perspective, although obviously we won't be talking about on that that on here. You know, we have some standards. So basically,
yeah, get your own point.
As I'm sure there are. So basically, put as I'm sure most of you know, phantom limbs are is a kind of condition experienced by amputees who still experience sensation in their non-existent amputated appendages. So, interestingly, it's been known to exist as a thing for centuries because people have been had limbs amputated for a very, very long time. I mean, it's been the go-to treatment for a lot of things for a very long time. So it's kind of unsurprising that these effects will manifest because it's quite common in amputees. What's interesting, therefore, is that it has not until relatively recently been the subject of kind of proper scientific, medical, and neurological analysis. I mean, up until relatively recently, and you can get the details of this from the book, doctors tended to do if someone complained of phantom limb, if it was a troublesome phantom limb, because often one of the problems with these is patients experience crippling chronic pain in their non-existent limb, which obviously presents something of a diagnostic and treatment conundrum.
I'm not saying that the pain isn't bad, but like itching.
Mm. Yeah.
Itching on something that isn't there. You're right about that.
Yeah. So we will actually hear more about that specifically, but yes. So, in the cases where people have phantom limbs that were extremely painful, what the doctors used to do was just amputate some more. Because,
of course.
Yeah, well, the idea was that like the nerve endings in the end of the limb where the stump was would have been a kind of bent around on themselves somehow. Again, read the book for the details. And that this was causing kind of like nociceptive, so pain sensation feedback. And that if they cut back further, they would remove these kind of troublesome nerve endings. And often this would happen like two or three times before they just gave up. So this isn't very good. And Ramachandran has devoted quite a lot of time to working out exactly what's going on in Phantom Limb and produce some very interesting results. So in the book, like the vast majority of the stuff he talks about is done on the basis of specific case studies. And the one that I'm going to talk about now is a guy called, in the book, Tom Sorensen. I suspect that that's a pseudonym, as most of these things usually are. So Tom Sorensen is described as a young man who lost his hand in a car accident. Warning, slightly grizzlily, he was thrown from a car and looked back into the car to see his hand still gripping the seat cushion, which is not cool in the slightest. He was fine in except that he didn't have a hand. And the problem was that he still could feel it. And in his case, he could still move it. So he was just, you know, when he describes his condition to Ramachandran, he says that, you know, he can reach and grab for objects and move it around. And that it often hurt, and particularly, as Tim mentioned, itches a lot. So a couple of, you know, specific things about this. He was in Ramachandran's office, and he reaches out for, Ramachandran gets him to reach out for a coffee cup. And then just as he's about to, you know, he sort of twists his body towards it. And just as he's about to grab the coffee cup, Ramachandran like yanks it away from him. And Tom goes, "Ah, why'd you do that? That really hurt, man," because he's American. So he still experiences like pain and feedback and physical, essentially physical sensation in it, which is crazy. But anyway, so this isn't particularly funny, incidentally. It's just kind of cool. And in the book, there are some funny bits later on about like sex and stuff, because that's our go-to source of humor.
Hooray.
So what Ramachandran found was whilst Tom could experience sensation in his hand, there were also other points on his body where, if touched, caused sensation in his phantom limb. So specifically, he got Tom to sit down and basically poked him all over with a Q-tip. This is like real hard science here. One of the things Ramachandran's really keen on is like really simple, basic studies to demonstrate quite complex concepts. So he poked Tom all over with this Q-tip and found that there was kind of like a map of his phantom hand present on Tom's face. So if he poked at kind of various points over the face, I just realized I was poking my own face to indicate.
We're working in an audio medium.
Hang on, I'll poke it like that. That might come through. Anyway, that probably sounded awful.
Did you feel that in your phantom limb?
Yes. Audience, did you feel that in your phantom face? Yeah, so there was kind of like an exact map of his hand, as in, it was a physiological map. So his thumb, the point where if you touched felt like the top end of his thumb was adjacent to the point that felt like it was the middle of his thumb, and next to his thumb knuckle, next to his palm, and so on and so forth. It mapped out accurately. And there was actually a second similar map on like the end of his stump, sort of facing the other way, where again, if he was touched there, it felt like his phantom limb was being touched.
So the like excessive amputators weren't as wrong as they sounded.
Well, sort of.
Like, yeah. The treatment might.
But
the theory that there was.
The theory is kind of right. So, the first thing result of this was that when Ramachandran explained this to him, Tom was like, "Fantastic! Now when my hand itches, I know where to scratch, because if he's got like an itchy hand, phantom hand, he can scratch his face or his stump, and presumably that would provide some alleviation." Now the explanation for this is based on this idea called the homunculus, or the physiological homunculus, which is this idea of how touch and physical sensation is represented in the brain. Basically, the areas of the brain where your touch sensation is represented are arranged structurally in kind of the same layout as your whole body. So there's a famous illustration of this little homunculus, which is a small man who, like, physical proportions are similar to the proportions of which different parts of your body are represented in the brain. So, for example, his hands are very large and his lips and genitals are very large because those are the areas that have the most neurons in the brain that represent touch sensation in them. So
it's kind of a horrifying image. I mean, I'll put it in the show notes, but it is a bit scary.
It is a little bit scary. But basically what happens is... I think if I remember correctly, this is represented in the parietal lobe, so kind of the top part of the brain. It's actually sort of backwards. So touch sensation in your feet is represented right at the top, and then that goes up to your legs, coming down in the brain. Your upper legs are below that, then your hips, and all the way up to your head, which is represented right at the bottom. So that kind of makes sense, because the way that Ramachandran reckons phantom limbs work is, say your hand is amputated, and like in Tom's case, you're no longer receiving sensory input from your hand, but the neurons in your brain that used to code for that sensation are still there. What you are receiving input from is your stump. So the parts of the brain that are directly adjacent to your lost hand, so the areas representing your arm, are receiving inputs. And what happens is that kind of activity from your arm kind of overspills into the hand representation areas, and so they become active. And because you've learned, you know, your brain represents those as your hand, it feels like your hand is being touched, which explains why Tom has a kind of map of his hand on his stump. What's really interesting is that although the homunculus, the representation of touch sensation in the brain, is mostly consistent with your anatomy, there are some weird inconsistencies. So, for example, your hand is actually represented quite in your brain, quite close to where your face is represented. Which explains once again why touch sensations in Tom's face kind of overspill onto his now kind of defunct hand area. And that's why he has a map on his face, which is kind of a really neat explanation and makes sense physiologically. The really weird thing about this that Ramachandran talks about is how this can be used to explain foot fetishes.
Which is, of course, a totally logical sidestep.
Yeah, it's the leaps of logic which actually then go on to make perfect sense. So another one of these strange little inconsistencies in the homunculus is the fact that touch sensation in your genitals are actually closer to your feet than they are to, say, your hips or thighs or whatever. So this would kind of make sense if people experience, you know, erotic sensations in their feet, because there's kind of in their brain, the two areas are very, very close. It also explains the fact that a lot of people who have foot amputations, some of them report erotic sensations in their phantom limbs, which is very peculiar. So there's a couple of patients who Ramachandran talks about who have had their feet amputated, but experience orgasm in their phantom foot. And Ramachandran was heard this and was like, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. And the guy was like, no, it's brilliant. My foot's really big.
I think
so.
I read that, put that to me, or I think you read it somewhere else. What I was going to ask about that is, it's interesting that Rama thinks this is a thing that needs to be explained, but then you look in some of the research that he cites and it's just like foot fetishes are far and away the statistically most prevalent non-originally sexual desire.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, people define fetishes in different ways, but if you think of it as a non-sexualized thing that becomes sexualized.
Yeah. So the interestingly, he then goes on to relate this to another non-sexual body part, which is often sexualized, which is earlobes in women. And what he points out is that the representation of the breasts in the brain is very close to the representation of the ears. And indeed, women who've had mastectomies often experience phantom breasts. And they get, you know, touch physical sensations or touch on their ears often manifests as sensation in their phantom breasts. And it also potentially explains why, according to some sources, some women have kind of erotic feedback from their ears. There you go. Try it out at home, kids.
It's amazing. Just like, oh, I've been studying some amputees and I've discovered this thing about...
Hold still, dear.
Eroticism. yeah, it's amazing. But, you know, did he discover anything else that could be done with the phantom limb? You know, did you just have to find the place? So it's like, oh, foot amputated. I've got to touch your genitals in order to, you know, cure phantom, you know, itching. But what about the pain?
Well, so this is the thing. Knowing where these little maps are does not necessarily cure a phantom limb. And this isn't particularly useful for the pain because you can't, it might be difficult to, I don't know, put anesthetic in someone's face and hope that that would stop the pain in their limb. However, one of the things that he thought was kind of important was that not all phantom limbs can move. So in Tom Sorensen's case, he was able to move his phantom hand around and reach for things and everything. A lot of people, particularly amputees who have only had their limb amputated after it's been paralyzed for a long time. And so it's removed kind of as a practicality because it's never going to regain movement. A lot of these cases, they're unable to move their phantom limb. And often this can be a very big problem because it, if it was in an awkward position or was causing them pain when it was paralyzed, then it will continue to do so and they'll be unable to move it. And a lot of them actually experience kind of the sensation of having their nail, if it's their arms that, or hands that have been amputated, they have the feeling of their nails digging into their palms and like a really tightly clenched fist, which can cause a lot of discomfort. So Ramachandran thought that maybe the first step for working out how to sort out or to cure these phantom limb cases was to try and regain movement in the phantom limb. And one of the things that he thought might be the problem is that your brain has kind of learnt to map out all its motion and its kind of action signals via visual feedback to its kind of motor systems. I'm not going to go into the detail of the neuroscience of it. Ramachandran devotes a whole chapter to it, and I haven't got time now, and it's not very funny. It's just interesting. So the idea is that the way you learn to kind of control the fine detail movements of your limbs is via a combination of visual feedback and what they call proprioception, which is like your innate ability to tell where your limbs are. Psychologists will hate me for using the word innate, but I'm going to anyway.
You know, one of the nine senses.
Yeah. what Ramachandran thought might be the problem is that in people who... let me see if I can get this right. If you are paralyzed, then you suddenly, you know, you have a lot of visual feedback while your limb is unamputated that sending action signals to it from your motor cortex doesn't produce the desired output. So eventually, because your brain is plastic and can learn, you stop being able to send action signals to it because your motor cortex is like, nope, no point. What he thought was maybe if somehow you could give visual feedback on the phantom limb, somewhat conversely, given that it's not there, you might be able to kind of trick the amputee's motor cortices into thinking that their limb was kind of there, and then they could kind of rejig themselves and reset themselves and at least be able to move the phantom limb around and maybe kind of reorganize themselves properly. So once again, he used this very simple setup where he got a cardboard box with the top cut off and two hand holes in the side. And then he put a mirror in the middle of it, facing sort of to one side, so that the amputees could put their existing hand into, say, their existing right hand into the right hand hole, and then they could orient their body so that the paralyzed phantom limb went through the other hole, and the mirror was arranged so that when the amputee looked down into the box, it appeared as if there were hands on both sides, because the mirror was reflecting the image of their existing remaining hand. What Ramachandran then told them to do was to move both hands at once in the same way. So, for example, raise both their index fingers. And miraculously, kind of, what happened was that these patients who had previously paralyzed phantom limbs, when they were receiving apparent visual feedback from both their limbs, suddenly their phantom limb was able to move again. And a lot of them were, you know, kind of elated at this, and they could kind of stretch them out and reduce the pain in them and move them around like guys like Tom Sorensen. And what was subsequently found in a couple of cases was that if these patients were allowed to take the mirror box home with them and practice on it regularly every day, after a week or so, a lot of the pain had started to subside. And after 3 weeks, in one case that Ramachandra describes, the phantom limb actually vanishes, goes away, and the patient no longer has a phantom limb. Now, I mean, this is kind
of... Isn't that incredible?
It's kind of magical, essentially, what it is.
I mean, it's just amazing.
And obviously, there are multiple caveats to this. You know, they have been experimenting with, you know, variations on this mirror box and all sorts of things. You can read about it in Ramachandran's more recent work. It doesn't work for all patients, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the principle of the idea that kind of reorienting the brain, using the brain's, it's kind of the plasticity of the brain that's causing the problem in the first place, because it's got itself confused, and using that self-same plasticity to reset the system and to resolve some of these really quite debilitating problems is just fantastic and fascinating. Not funny, but very cool. You have the fetish part for the funniness.
Yeah, and hopefully it's interesting. Well, shall I talk about some other stuff he's done? Because that would be enough for one career, really, wouldn't it? Just be like, oh, I figured out a way that you can consistently cure phantom limbs in many patients. That was my life's work. Where's my Nobel Prize? Not Ramachandra.
He's Indian.
Yeah, because I'm not going to try and do an Indian accent.
I know all accents eventually trend to Indian, but... anyway.
Yeah.
Have you not experienced that? Whenever you try and do an accent inexpertly.
I avoid trying to do accents, to be honest. I really can't do them. It's a real weakness, and I wish I could. So Ramachandran has done many other things. One of them was the field of anosognosia, which I'll tell you two key things about that. First thing, it is hard to say. I had a 1.5-hour tutorial on anosognosia, and even though I'd been practicing beforehand, you cannot say a word that is that hard that many times without losing your mind.
And your nose.
And there's a scientific reason for that, but we'll talk about that another week. It is a type of delusion, and I studied delusions for my advanced options in finals, which was a fascinating topic. And it's a delusion where you deny an ailment despite all evidence to the contrary. Most commonly, it comes with the paralysis associated with strokes, which is hemiplegia, when one half of the body is paralyzed. Now, Ramachandran wanted to find out whether people who have anosognosia subconsciously know that they're paralyzed, because there's a lot of stroke-based conditions that only impact the conscious mind, whereas the subconscious or the unconscious or whatever, I mean, we're being polite modern psychologists, we would say the word implicit knowledge. And when you test people implicitly, they show knowledge that they don't have explicitly. And because of this, people try and say anosognosia is psychodynamic. But Rama says, no way, Sigmei. One, that anosognosia is massively lateralized. So when the right brain is damaged, basically everyone gets anosognosia for at least a bit.
Right.
And I think the only cases when the left brain is damaged and shows anosognosia is when they have reversed dominance. So it's essentially the same as if they'd had right brain damage. Also, you get cases where anosognosia only applies to some conditions. So they'll say, oh, my leg is fine, but my arm is paralyzed, when it's the whole half of the body. And so some people say, okay, well, maybe it's not psychodynamic, and who thought it would be? Maybe it's neglect. Now, neglect is basically the science of the perception filter in Doctor Who. It's when your attention system just can't focus on a certain area, which is usually one half of space. So Ramap thinks, well, maybe anosognosia is the same. Is there an awareness that they are paralyzed that's just below the conscious level? And so he goes to some paralyzed patients and he asks one of them over and over again to point at something with her left hand. At first, she comes up with excuses. She says, oh, my shoulder aches. And then she says, I don't feel like pointing, which is a rather dull Scissor Sisters B-side. And finally, she admits, okay, I'm paralyzed. And 10 minutes later, he says, oh, you know how 10 minutes ago you said your hand was paralyzed? She was like, no way. I just did those tests. I pointed at all those things you asked me to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their memory's completely gone. And so people say, oh, right, it's amnesia then, isn't it? They're cloudy, they've got dementia, they've had a massive stroke. But Ramachandran tests them in every other domain, you know, with standardized neuro tests, and finds that they're absolutely fine. So the trouble is here is that the best explanation seems like it's, well, it's a bit awkward that I have to say this. It's Freudian. I'll try not to say that too many again. They use rationalization, euphemism, distraction, distorted memories. All of them are classic Freudian defense mechanisms. And given that we've assigned Freud as the F word, does that mean a Freudian defense mechanism is a chastity belt?
Oh.
Anyway, I'll move away from that quickly.
Coughing with disgust.
Okay, Ramachandran suggests that anosognosia might be an extreme version of Freudian defense mechanisms. And that's the thing about Ramachandran, is he is willing to try anything or think anything until he's given it a go and tried to work it out. You know, we're dismissive of Freud mostly because it's funny, and probably then secondarily because we want to bust out of the popular perception of psychologists. You know, in the media, people still think Freud is like this big deal in psychology, and so, you know, that's why we dislike talking about him. But, you know, the thing that put Ramachandran among real psychologists is he goes, okay, well, maybe there are Freudian defense mechanisms. How can I test this experimentally? So the thing that puts him among Renaissance men is he goes, in part two, I'll use those experiments as a starting point for putting together a number of highly speculative ideas on diverse topics such as REM sleep, dreaming, and laughter. Because that is a thing he does. Phantom limbs? Well, that explains fetishes. Anosognosia? Well, that explains why we dream and why we laugh.
It's kind of like the, well, I have just explained one miracle. I'm now going to go on to another seven in the, like, discussion and footnotes.
Exactly. So he had four patients with anosognosia that he experimented on, because these disorders are really rare. And he set up some games. And they would do a task for a prize, either a one-handed task, like picking up a toy octopus with a fishing hook and putting it into a cup, which I think is really cute, for a small prize, which would either be $2, some scented soap, or a small box of candy, or a two-handed task to tie the laces of a baby shoe, which is also a really cute task, for a big prize, which would be $5, a ceramic angel, or a large box of candy. So controls obviously do the two-handed task for the big prizes. Paralyzed controls do the one-handed task because they know they can't complete the two-handers, and you don't get the prize if you fail. What I want to know is, why isn't this on ITV Primetime? You know that there's going to be a new game show on ITV Primetime presented by Jeremy Kyle. I know, it's terrifying. Anyway, so all of these patients with anosognosia who are genuinely paralyzed at one half of their body keep picking the bimanual task and keep failing. They don't get frustrated, and Rama just has to go, okay, you can stop now. And they never learnt either, despite remembering all sorts of details that show that their memory is working in other ways. For example, remembering that Rama had come in with his brain scans tie, which makes me feel close to him because I have a brain scans t-shirt, which apparently his students regularly didn't notice which tie he was wearing each day. I do wonder how he tests that. Is he, you know, if I was his student, I would be just on the lookout for anything that he asked me. So that, he's thinking, there is no subconscious knowledge. But he thought, oh, I'll try something else, I'll make sure. He got one of his patients to try and pick up a tray of cocktail glasses, which every good neuropsychiatric ward has lying around. And she tried to pick up the cocktail tray as if she had two working hands. And Rama had to save the glasses with lightning reflexes.
Which she obviously has, being like psychology ninja.
Oh, exactly. He has superpowers. So
maybe like Psychology Neo, like.
You can see the structure of the Matrix, and that's how he knows all this stuff. Okay, so he is pretty sure they don't have any subconscious knowledge, but he still wants to make absolutely sure. So he got out the old faithful mirror box, or a cheaper version, the virtual reality box. Now, the virtual reality box is very similar to the mirror box, except it doesn't have a reflection of your hand in. It has one of Rama's apprentice's hands in, and so you get the person to
still attached to the apprentice, not like
yes, oh yes, and you put your hand in, you think your hand is in there, but it's someone else's, and so you get them to tap their non-paralyzed hand, their right hand, get used to tapping, because you know, and then ask them to do it with their left hand, and then get the apprentice to tap the beat as if they are moving their paralyzed hand. Now, normally people are surprised by this, you know, people with paralyzed hands, even if it only shows in skin conductance. But an anosognosic is just like, yeah, I can tap with my left hand. It's not paralyzed.
The just a brief tangent there. It something you can try at home. You can actually do this same thing on yourself, essentially. And Ramachandran describes like three fun take-home ways of giving yourself like the experience of phantom limbs. One of the way he's describes it is if you hide one of your hands underneath a table that you're sitting at, and then someone stands next to you and taps on top of the table, and kind of unseen to you, taps on your hand as well. If they do it for long enough, you will eventually start to feel like the table is your arm, kind of thing, and you will be able to like feel the whole table, which is amazing. I desperately want to try that.
I've heard that the kind of principle behind that is rhythm. That our brains absolutely love rhythm, and I imagine if we ever do a music episode, that will be like a key element of it. The fact that you can use rhythm to change your body representation.
If we did a music episode, I would keep wanting to make it a musical episode, but that would probably end badly. And yes, in terms of the rhythm, he says if you do, if the person doing the tapping does a more irregular beat, then that works much better because your brain is like, well, it must be that because it's not a regular
thing. It's so unlikely.
Which is kind of cool.
Thinking of rhythm, Rama asked her to clap this paralyzed patient, and she moved her right hand in a clapping fashion. And when Ramachandran said, are you clapping? She's like, yes, of course I'm clapping. And he claims that this is the solution to the Zen question of what is the sound of one hand clapping?
Which is, in fact, the title of a chapter in his book.
Oh, really? I love that, though. That he's just like, Hey guys, you know that Zen problem that's troubled people for over 1,000 years? I have an answer. Look at her. So, because he was interested in the Freudian side of this, he did notice that people were getting a bit overcompensatory. So, when he sent in his student to ask the patients, oh, you know, what is Professor Ramachandran, or Dr. Ramachandran, I don't know what they would refer to him as, maybe doctor in that context, been doing with you? They said, oh, we've been doing some tasks. I did that task with both hands, which he said no normal person would say. And so he thought, well, maybe the memories are encoding properly, but they're just so repressed. So, you know, did he sit them on a couch, talk them through the stuff, or do a Rorschach blot test, or whatever else psychodynamicists do? Of course not. Ramachandran has a little secret in his arsenal.
That would be
arsenal.
Too easy.
It would be too normal. He has a secret in his arsenal. It's the secret cure for paralysis. The secret cure for pretty much any massive brain damage. He didn't discover it, which is a rarity, but he basically tries it on any brain condition he can find. And it does sound like something straight out of the playbook of Bob Zients. because what it involves is pumping cold water into the left ear, which massively increases the brain metabolism in that hemisphere to either the extent that it takes over functions from the other side, or it re-stimulates the damaged right hemisphere, or possibly it reorientates the body in space like the mirror box, because it kind of the vestibular system is in your ear, so it's just like, whoa, I'm all weirdly balanced, and then you go, okay, back to normal, and suddenly it gets rid of various conditions. It also makes you feel abject nausea, like really hardcore nausea, and gives you nystagmus, which is involuntary eye movement. So there are some downsides to it. So he did this on this woman. It had already been shown to have a good effect on neglect, but obviously he'd shown that it's not quite the same as neglect. But she was, yeah, able to remember, this patient of his, that she was paralyzed, and indeed that she had been for some time. And when the effect ended, she could neither remember that she was paralyzed nor that she had ever admitted it. So she, you know, when Ramachandran asked her, well, what did you say when I put the water in your ear? She said, well, I said I was fine because I'm fine. So what Ramachandran does at this point is he puts together an idea super collider and tries to combine Freud and Darwin, which in my mind suggests that this theory will have an epic beard.
You have to smash them very close together somewhere in...
Yeah. Oh, did you hear the neutrino business?
Europe.
The neutrino business probably is the fault of special relativity to do with the tracking satellites.
Ah, I did hear that they'd kind of resolved it and that the universe wasn't going to collapse.
Yeah, Einstein is still right, so that's good.
Yeah, that is lucky.
So he, Ramachandran cites evidence from his other studies that what we go for in terms of perception is coherence. That little bits of conflicting evidence, they get chucked out. And it's basically true in emotion or cognition, except in those cases, it's not really an optical illusion you get because you've chucked out the kind of little bits of conflicting evidence. You get a story. So a patient with a nosognosia, for example, denies that someone with the same disability is failing in the same way they deny their own disabilities. And if you're getting these two feeds of information, a damaged motor and somatosensory cortex, like the people with phantom limb, and a working visual cortex, you have to pick a story between the two things they're telling you that are contradictory, or else you will go mad. And humans just are incapable of not deciding and saying, oh, well, I don't know. You have to pick one. And so Ramachandra says, okay, fine. Why don't we just jump on absolutely any belief as soon as there's something odd happens? Otherwise, we'd like end up repressing everything unpleasant. And that wouldn't really happen. Help us avoiding threats, you know, in the evolutionary environment. We'd keep forgetting that the silence were there and they'd control us for centuries.
Long Doctor Who this episode.
I've clearly been watching too much of it. Ramachandran thinks, okay, well, maybe the right hemisphere's job is as the devil's advocate, looking for stories that go a bit too far past what the evidence says. You know, it's okay to ignore 1 in 100 anomalies, but if it's about 50-50, it's not okay to just go, oh, well, that one is right. Right hemisphere, in my mind, is the whoa there hemisphere. So if you have massive right brain damage and the left hemisphere gets out of control and you have all these delusions and confabulations, and what happens in the reverse case, the Mr. Mental Storyteller left hemisphere is taken out, is that patients suffer profound depression because they can't even rationalize a little bit. The left hemisphere copes with anomaly by ignoring little bits, but the right hemisphere is for doing the big paradigm shifts. And that much sounds crazy, but that's literally just all part one, the normal scientific elements. He jumps then into the completely speculative stuff. So he says, for example, theories of humor and laughter go all the way back to Kant and Schopenhauer, two singularly humorless German philosophers.
Excellent.
He then goes on to suggest that twists to what is expected aren't necessarily aubergine. You know, the twist has to be inconsequential rather than we're all going to die. You know, he says, if I'm flying back to San Diego and the captain goes, the plane's going to explode, that's unexpected, but it's not especially funny unless it turns out he's remaking Airplane. But So what humour is it comes when you make the big paradigm shift, the right hemisphere bit, too early, so that then you have to jump back, and this builds up emotion. He reckons that evolutionarily, laughter indicates to anyone who had made this shift, the right hemisphere shift, that, for example, a few sounds are a threat, that it's not a threat. So if you laugh at You've Been Framed, which is Kenneth Branagh's favourite comedy show, it's because people have fallen over and your brain assumes, oh no, they're horribly injured, and then it turns out they're not too bad. That's why you laugh. Of course, in You've Been Framed, I think they ran out of all of the ones where people aren't badly hurt and are now just on the ones that is just pain, and maybe the laughter response is a bit premature. So one thing that we can do is we can use humour as a defence mechanism by responding to something that is a threat with the response that says no threat, which is laughter, which is an interesting idea. I don't know whether it works. I'll have to remember the next time I'm faced with a tiger to just go, I'm not scared anymore because I'm going laughing.
Well, what about the whole kind of every comedian's life story ever, that every stand-up comedian's life story ever, which starts with I was small and weedy and picked on at school, so I turned to making people laugh.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different sort of defense mechanism.
Yeah, it's kind of a leap.
He means it in the sort of Freudian sense that it protects our ego rather than it protects us from being beaten up by bullies.
Gallows humor.
I bet he would try and explain everything if he had any time. But so what happens when you've done this vestibular stimulation, putting the water in the person's ear, is the memory coming back because the right hemisphere is detecting an anomaly and going, you know, whoa, I just woke up again. Someone gave me a power boost. Someone gave me a can of Relentless. And Ramachandra doesn't say no to that, but he does have some other ideas. He notices that the involuntary eye movement looks just like REM sleep. And I don't mean that part of their face turns blue. I was quite proud of that joke. Dreams have unrepressed memories, he says, and so does vestibular stimulation. Now, animals' vestibular neurons go crazy during REM sleep, so they're dreaming awake when you're putting the water in their ears. Mm-hmm. When you're awake, the left hemisphere wants everything to stick to the script, and dreaming is when the right hemisphere holds its improv group.
Yeah.
If it comes up with a good narrative, then it might be allowed to be experienced consciously. So that's why psychoanalysis really is difficult, because when you're awake, it's just quite hard to de-repress stuff and come up with a new narrative for it. And I guess that's why they used hypnosis in the early days.
Makes sense.
So I
mean, don't know if it's true, but it makes sense.
What Ramachandra says is, this, in my view, is exactly what happens every time you dream. You open your top secret files and psychoanalyze yourself. So, he says, this isn't a sort of psychoanalysis that in the Freudian sense, because Freudians would believe in wish fulfillment, whereas a nosognosic will dream of being paralyzed, because in their dream, they can deep repress that memory. He says, because dreams allow you to do risky things without consequences. In Ramachandran's case, this is apparently to sleep with your boss's wife. So he suggests that damages to the hippocampus, and yes, he does cite Squire, so drink, that makes you repress everything. The hippocampus has some control over the extent to which you repress things. And so he concludes by saying, no engineer in his right mind, for example, could have foreseen a link between the inner ear and cognitive functions such as memory retrieval, dreams, or Freudian psychology. It's like, yeah, no psychologist in his right mind thought that.
You, Ramachandran.
And he hasn't tested everything, but he does note that right hemisphere patients do struggle with jokes and humour. And although I think that might be language-based, he thinks that it's these problems of symbolic meaning that come up in the language problems that come from right hemisphere damage will be the most pronounced when they are related to Freudian topics, like the meaning of sour grapes. It is something that if you don't understand the symbolic meaning, you'll struggle with, because its literal meaning doesn't really mean anything. But he reckons because sour grapes is all about kind of confabulation and Freudian defense mechanisms, that will be something that someone with right hemisphere damage will really struggle with.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
that's the thing about Ramachandran, is I think we let him off the hook in a way that I don't let, for example, Bob Science off the hook, just because, one, he will try and experimentally prove it, which I suppose Science did, but there's just something about the way he goes about it that just seems so, he's just trying to throw ideas out there and see what sticks.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, anyone can, you know, just hurl random ideas, hurl, you know, theoretical mud at the wall and hope that some of it sticks. But it's so kind of tangential, the stuff that he comes up with, and yet it makes he makes the links seem so obvious. So kind of, why didn't I think of that?
Yeah.
Even with his most crazy ideas, and you, they're always testable.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose so. I suppose it's time just to wrap up. I don't know if we can draw any conclusions about the work of Ramachandran, which we have genuinely scratched the surface of.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is maybe... I think the Capgras stuff, the mirror, Agnosia, and obviously the Phantom Limbs, I think they are all mentioned in Phantoms in the Brain. I'm not completely sure about the Capgras stuff, but I mean, that's like three chapters out of many. He talks about so much stuff in that. I think that, I mean, the conclusion is basically he's awesome. Read his stuff.
Watch his TV fans. Show.
Watch the TV show. Yeah. I'm not sure where you might find it, but it's probably on like Amazon or something.
Oh yeah, I wasn't going to suggest Amazon.
Fine. So basically, the conclusions to go through are, probably like foot fetishes are real, and nibble on.
I don't think anyone ever denied that.
No.
But they can be explained by neuroscience.
Can be explained by neuroscience.
As can bits and pieces of Freud, but not necessarily the way Freud expected.
Mirrors are actually portals to another dimension in some cases.
Yes, but only if you've got neglect. It's amazing what you can treat just by sticking some cold water in the ear.
Racism is Capgras delusion.
Laughter is to do with the relationship between the two hemispheres and the buildup of tension in their attempts to understand reality as separate entities, as is dreaming.
Americans have different standards of conversational fluency. That's true. That's pretty good.
Minotaurs are cool.
Minotaurs are cool. Any you know, academic or meaningful advancement I make in my life will now seem insignificant in comparison to the fact that A, he was published in Nature in his second year of undergrad, and B, he has a frigging dinosaur, a Freuding dinosaur named after him. Would be a very strange dinosaur indeed.
Well, I always thought the Triceratops was overcompensating for something.
Have you? How is the Triceratops the first thing you go to? The Brontosaurus is essentially a giant phallus.
You mean the Brontosaurus is the one that doesn't exist, isn't it? Or is that Diplodocus?
Maybe
I can never remember.
I think the Diplodocus doesn't exist.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
We're not paleontologists. We don't really know.
Although we begin with the same letter, so surely we have like some grounds for talking knowledgeably about it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That famous Oxford course, PPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPPP I can't remember what the others are. Physics. Physics.
Yeah. They should do that. P to the power 6.
Like a P6, like a P6. I think we should get off this boat while it's still going.
Let's do that. Yep. Thank you for listening. Feedback to all the usual sources, psychomediapodcast@gmail.com. And
at Tetrarchangel. Sorry, yeah. Too early this week.
We'll get it right eventually. And thank you for the ridiculous amount of feedback. That was wonderful. Thank you particularly to all the like crazy cool actual podcast people who are listening. And you are entirely to blame for the fact that this is an exceptionally long one.
Well, you and Professor Larry Squire.
Yeah.
Damn you, Squire!
It's nearly a catchphrase. It's so nearly a catchphrase.
Bye. Bye.
Anyway, thank you for listening. And goodbye.
Tim and Ben will return in the Brain Classics, an all-new adventure. The theme song will be sung by Justin Bieber, featuring Napalm Death. The villain will be played by Professor Larry Squire. The expected release date is the 28th of October 2011, unless our studio goes bust, in which case it'll take about 2 years.